There are 7.2 billion of us living here on spaceship Earth, and we'll add another 100 million or so this year alone. Knowing every country will need more food to feed the future, financial speculators are using billions to buy up farmland throughout the world. And so farmers who once owned land are now becoming farmers who rent land. This leads us to ask, can farmers who rent farmland sustain it for the future?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1021st edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Lisbon who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Hello, Jason.
Always a pleasure, Michael.
Folks, try this. Walk, ride, or drive through any residential street anywhere in the world and guess which residence is owned and which is rented. It's really easy because of two elemental facts. Fact one, owners must keep their residence in good shape or lose some of the value in what they have invested. Second fact, renters do not keep their residence in tip-top shape because to do so would be to spend their time and money to increase a landlord's time and money. Doesn't make any sense, right? So the well-maintained homes and yards you see are most likely occupied by their owners, while those not so well-maintained are most likely occupied by renters. Now, please turn your attention to the world's farmland. Knowing every country needs more farmland to feed the future, financial speculators are buying up farmland throughout the world. And so farmers who once owned farmland now must rent it. And so today we pause to ask, can farmers who rent farmland sustain it for the future? Well, here to help us answer that question, we have one of my favorites, Anuradha Mittal, who is the founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute. Anuradha, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael, for having me.
So good to have you aboard. Folks, also, we're looking for Dean Kuipers, who is the author and writer of Buying the Farm, which appeared in Orion Magazine, to join us here today. I don't know what happened to him, but hoping he'll join us. He wrote an article in which Anuradha appeared about buying the farm, which is exactly what we're talking about today, is the investment firms who are pooling their money and buying up farmland around the world. Anuradha, let's start with the Oakland Institute. What exactly is the Oakland Institute? Are you located in Oakland?
Well, definitely so. We are called the Oakland Institute because we are based in Oakland. We are an independent policy think tank. We do research and analysis on social, economic, environmental issues that we feel are very pertinent to our lives.
Mm-hmm. And one of them being farmland.
Definitely. Agriculture with focus on farmland has been a key focus of our work over the last few years.
Good. Well, we always ask, Anuradha, who pays the way? So who pays the way for the Oakland Institute?
Well, we do not accept any government or corporate funding. Our support comes from individual donors. It comes from private charities, small family foundations, and faith-based groups such as the Presbyterians.
Oh, so then you're not getting any money from great big huge corporations or anything then?
No, as a matter of policy, we do not accept money. Even if they wanted to give it to us, we would not accept it.
Okay, fair enough. So there we are. We have some an Oakland Institute that does not accept money from people who would like to influence how it enforces its decisions. So away we go. Well, looking around the world, is this something we're seeing happening everywhere? You know, Google stock just went through the roof yesterday. So why would anybody buy farmland when they can buy Google stock that's going through the roof, Anuradha?
That's an excellent question, Michael. I mean, as you said, the global rush for land is precisely that, global. You know, it is estimated that nearly 500 million acres worth of land investments were made just in the developing countries between 2000 and 2011. But the same is happening in countries such as Australia or right here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And we see also on your where a lot of farmland in Africa is being bought up as well.
Well, you know, when I talk about the global investments, nearly 70 to 75% of that is in Africa. But I think what many of us don't realize is that over the next 20 years, nearly 400 million acres of land, which is nearly half of the country's farmland, is set to change hands as the current generation retires. And you have nearly $10 billion in capital, which is looking for access to this U.S. farmland. So as you said, Michael, like here, the Google stocks just went through the roof. Why would people be interested in investing in farmland? Now, first of all, given all that has happened, you know, we have seen the dot-com bubble burst. We have seen the housing market bubble burst. So investors are seeing agriculture as a stable investment with very solid returns, especially in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. Farmland is seen as a very safe place to stash your capital until more profitable investments emerge.
So when people look at this, at, you know, where to put their money, they could put their money in the stock market, which has been going through the roof for the past few years. But that's kind of based on silly money when it gets right down to it, because this, you know, who knows where that's going to go? It's just, it's just electronic digits stored in some computer. Chinese could come in and turn off all the lights, and that would be the end of everything. So there's that kind of investment, which has been pretty good. Like I said, Google went through the roof yesterday. There's gold, but gold doesn't really do anything except sit there like a lump on a log and look pretty. And yet it holds its value very well. And then there is farmland, which is kind of like gold, but it can make money for you. So there's some attractiveness in farmland because it's real. And if the entire world falls apart, people will still need to eat.
I think you've said it very well. I mean, there are a lot of interest because you have ecological, economic, and political factors. We all know that the pressures on global arable land are increasing because of climate change, urbanization. We have pollution-induced land degradation. So investors think that acquiring fertile land will also help them secure water rights today, which will provide profits in the face of, you know, if there's scarcity tomorrow. Mm-hmm. There are also other long-term trends. You have rising meat consumption. You have biofuel production. You have increased need for farmland. And as you said, compared to things like gold, which are also increasing in value, unlike that, what you can do with land is not just wait for the value of land to increase. You can rent it out so you can be making monies even today. So farmland has become very attractive for, you know, and I'm not talking about agribusinesses here. We're talking about pension funds. We're talking about private equity funds, hedge funds. Who are investing in farmland today?
So that's something we're going to get to in a minute. But I also like to draw a line between buying farmland to farm and buying farmland to build a strip mall. Because one of the greatest impacts on farmland, the greatest forces working against it, has been urbanization. Whereas, you know, the best cities grow in the best farmland, and so they keep growing out and out and out and keep eating up more and more and more farmland. Do you draw a distinction between those two?
Oh, definitely. I think especially in the United States, when we are seeing the change in ownership of land, those are very key questions. Because you have to see that who owns the farmland determines. So when land is, you know, it's a commodity which is owned by absentee interest, it is producing commodities for export, or it might be used to create, you know, a Gulf resort community, or it might be used for some other purpose. In cases of places such as Africa or in Papua New Guinea, we are seeing a lot of this land taken over for developing palm oil plantations or leaving the land alone just for speculative purposes, or using that land for growing crops for export.
So there it is, folks. A lot of pressure being put on farmland throughout the world, not only here in the United States where those people who have been farming for a long time are having trouble finding land to buy. It seems to be pretty easy to find land to rent, but finding it to buy is another question. So when we come back, we're going to talk with Anya Rada and maybe Dean Kuipers, who will tune in, about finding who is buying up all of this farmland and where they are getting the money. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating Rut Radio. It is the 1021st edition of the Food Chain with Anya Rada Mittal, and she is the founder and executive director of the Oakland Institute, looking around at seeing how the world works and finding those places that we really need to focus on, one of them being farmland. You are invited to participate today. The key question we have on the table today: can farmers who rent farmland sustain it for the future? 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lambs.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, I have a little challenge for you. Drive down any residential street in the world and guess which house or which home is occupied by the owner and which by the renter. I bet you can figure it out just by looking, by appearances, because those people who own those properties, those homes, are pretty much forced to keep them up. Otherwise, they lose the value of their investment. Whereas those people who are just renting really can't afford to invest their time and money into keeping up somebody else's investment, so they don't tend to do so. Now apply that to farmland throughout the world. So much of the world's farmland is now being bought up. And we look at that, how that is turning farmers who traditionally owned their land into renters of the land. And we're wondering, can those renters of farmland afford or find a way to sustain that farmland for the future? That's the question on the table today. We have with us Anya Rada Mittal, who is the executive director of the Oakland Institute. We also have Dean Kuipers, who is the author of Buying the Farm, which is the how this story started on the Food Chain today. Dean, welcome. Good to have you aboard.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
So how is it the city boy from Los Angeles is writing a story about buying the farm for OrionMagazine.org?
Well, that's a good question. Well, first of all, there's a lot of urban agriculture going on here in Los Angeles, which you may or may not be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But my family still lives in Michigan, and I spend a lot of time out there. In fact, I just turned back from a month in Michigan, and there's a lot of connections to the farming community there. So I pay a lot of attention to farming issues.
Mm-hmm. And besides that, you probably eat too, right?
Yes, I'm an eater.
Good for
like
you.
A lot of us. You know, we need to know where our food comes from. Obviously, it's a bit of a cliche these days, but it's becoming more and more evident that we don't have to just pay lip service to that idea. We actually do have to know where all of our food comes from, and I, like a lot of other people, am very concerned about that.
Well, we're going to jump quickly from Dean to Anya Rada and ask both of you, I guess. Anya Rada, let's start with you. Who is buying up all the farmland, and where are they getting all the money?
Well, first of all, in countries around the world, people are not necessarily buying up the land. What we have seen is 99-year leases for, cheap dirt prices. you're paying in countries such as Tanzania or Ethiopia, you know, at most, you know, $7 a hectare, or in Tanzania we have seen deals for, you know, less than 20 cents a hectare per year. And this is the land for which you would be paying anywhere from $14,000 to $16,000 per hectare in the Midwest, or $26,000 per hectare in UK, or even in Indonesia or Malaysia, you would be paying at least $5,000 to $6,000 per hectare. So the monies that
that's not only cheap, that's dirt cheap.
Dirt cheap. And, you know, we have seen, I mean, this is not happening through consent of the local people. There's no such thing as pre-prior informed consent. And these are not just family farmers. These are agro-pastoralists. These are the indigenous communities that have been the stewards of the land in places, who have used the waters of the Nile or who have used the waters of River Omo in very responsible ways. And all of that is being thrown away to impose this industrial agriculture system, which is being promoted as a way to bring development and so-called food security and jobs and infrastructure to African nations. Our exposés clearly show that this is nothing else but a takeover and a theft of natural resources in developing countries. But just to answer your question in terms of who is taking over the land, very often what we hear is it's the Gulf states, it's the Chinese, it's the Koreans and Malaysians.
It's certainly them, but not us, right?
Exactly, to ensure food security. Now, I can tell you at the Institute, we have looked at hundreds and hundreds of land deals all over Africa. We have looked at Latin America, Asia, Papua New Guinea. Just about everyone is involved. From, as I said, you know, you have the Dutch Pension Fund, you have Norfund, you have DFID invested, the Development Agency of United Kingdom. We have seen investors from New York, you know, Heracles Farms, which was involved in Cameroon. We have seen Agrisol, which was Iowa-based, Bruce Rastetter, that was of Summit Farms, that was involved in it. We have seen a U.S. former ambassador for refugee affairs take over, you know, a million hectares of land in South Sudan for $25,000. So just to be clear, in this land rush, every actor who's looking to make a quick buck and some profits is involved.
Dean, what are we seeing here in the United States?
Well, it's not quite the same situation that Anurata has described there internationally, but it's a version of it. I think in the last decade or so, and a little bit longer probably, very large institutional investors like some of the folks she's mentioning have begun to regard farmland here in the U.S. as a good place to park some of their money. Especially after the crash of 2008, there was a bit of a rush to see like what kind of farmland deals could be made out there. And the reasons are twofold, well, three actually. First, they own the land. So these groups are moving in, you know, a large like pension fund or a large hedge fund will move in to own the land, which is has some value, of course, right off the bat. But there's also some speculation in that land, so there's some chance that that price may go way up. But while they're waiting for that price to go up, meanwhile, it produces food, which they can sell. So as one investor described it, it's like gold with yield. So you're holding it, and it's producing a yield at the same time.
Best of both worlds.
Exactly, and when it works. Now, I do have to say that in the last couple of years, there's been a tiny bit of a downturn in that, so maybe some of the steam has come off that trend a little bit, but in the long term, it can't go anywhere but up, I would imagine, mm-hmm. because land prices will continue to go up and food prices will continue to go up.
So when we talk about these large money interests, we're talking about people who pool money together. And, yeah. You know, there are lots of different organizations and businesses that specialize in pooling people's money. You know, I think of a teacher's retirement fund, for example. You know, they have a never-ending stream of money pouring into them, and what are they going to do with it? So one of the ways that they can invest that is buying Google stock, and the other might be buying farmland. So that's what they're doing.
Yes. And we certainly should get Anurata to jump in on this, but I think that we should probably start this discussion by saying there wouldn't be a problem with that as long as they take good care of the farmland.
Well, now that's a great place to jump. why not take good care of the farmland? These people are owners. Why shouldn't they take good care of it, Anuradha?
Well, I think you have to really understand that the people, you know, when we talk about UBS AgriVest, for instance, the Swiss, you know, agency which provides financial services to large corporations and institutional clients, which holds a dizzying $2.39 trillion in invested assets. You know, it is not an agricultural business, or it is not an agricultural family that even knows how to do agriculture or knows ABC of agriculture. What they tend to do is to rent out the lands to other people to farm it, or they bring on farm management services. And if you look at a report down on the farm, we show that when Hancock or when Thiercref or when UBS get into land and get into agriculture and bring on third parties to farm the lands, there's a very detached relationship to the land. Because as you said before, when land is held locally, it is operated by family members, it is operated by neighbors who have connection to the place. You get great land stewardship, you get job creation, when you get services and diversification of the landscape. People are thinking about, you know, food security for
people. People are thinking about the future.
And people are thinking about the future. But if I come in and I'm thinking that I can get more money by growing, you know, some special grass for some special breed horses in Japan, I will use the land in any way I can for the short-term purpose. But you have to understand the biggest thing, and we report it in our in Down on the
Farm. Wait a minute. Hold that thing. Hold. We've got to learn about the biggest thing when we get back from this break. So don't anybody go anywhere, because Anuradha is going to put the big chip on the table when we get back. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Can farmers who rent farmland sustain it for the future? Dean Kuipers, the author of Buying the Farm and OrionMagazine.org, and Anuradha Mittal. Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, you know, folks, I thought I was a good renter, because I would actually occasionally cut the lawn, and if a board fell out of the fence, I'd prop it back up. But when I think back on it, I probably was just a renter. But now I'm an owner, and I'm out there on my hands and knees picking weeds. And that really is the difference, because when you're an owner, you just have to take care of your property. It's your property. It's your future. You just have to take care of it. But when it's somebody else's property and their money and their investment, you really can't afford to take care of it, can you? And so that's the question on the table today. Can farmers who once owned farmland but now rent farmland sustain that farmland for the future? As owners, they always thought of the future. They thought of their family's future and their children's children's future. But as renters, what's the future? So that's the question on the table today. Curious to know what you think. 831-479-1980. We have Dean Kuipers, who is the author of Buying the Farm, in OrionMagazine.org. You can read the article right there, and it's pretty much exactly where we're going today. Also with us, Anuradha Mittal, who is the executive director of the Oakland Institute, and she has the big chip to put on the table right now. Anuradha, what is the big reason?
Well, I think what we have seen around the world, including in the United States, the kind of investors that are getting into farmland, their interest is capital gain, which is the increase in the asset's value, which is only realized upon the resale of the asset. This is seen as the main source of profits from their farm investment. So this would suggest that flipping farm properties later is more important than taking care of the land, being good stewards of the land, or even the returns from rental payments or crop sales today. So what happens is, with this kind of behavior, it is putting an upward pressure on farm prices, which is on one hand making it impossible for the young and the beginning farmers to access land in places such as the United States. And in places like Africa, of course, it is just denying any opportunity to work your own land. What it's doing is it's turning former family farmers into sharecroppers and plantation workers on their own fields. Let me give you an example of that in terms of speculation. If you look at Wexford Capital, which is a Connecticut-based hedge fund, in 2007 and 2008, it invested $95 million in U.S. farmland, and it boasted that it would build the Walmart farming operation of the world. In 2012, when it announced it was liquidating its entire farmland portfolio, it pocketed a cool $64 million in profit. Now, that is the incentive as well when you find UBS or Hancock or entities that have nothing to do with agriculture getting invested in land and in farmland.
Well, Dean, how do you see this incredible flipping of farmland, kind of like they do in real estate shows on television where you buy a house for a little bit and sell it for a lot? How do you see that impacting farm ownership here in the United States?
Yeah, this is an important comment to make, I think, in that there's a difference between what Anurata is describing, which is accurate, and what really has gone on in traditional farming, because really today a large number and maybe even the majority of farmers rent their land. So that's been going on for a long, long time. The folks that I visit, the Wilkins family out in Illinois, out in Danforth, Illinois, where my story, I take my story in Orion magazine, those guys rent a lot of their land. And they are incredibly good stewards, and the point of going to visit them is they are flipping all of that farmland at their own expense to organic. And
which is explain that too, because that's a very interesting notion, because it goes really kind of contrary to what I've been saying.
Yes.
I've been saying that if you're a renter, it's hard to build organic soil for somebody else.
It is, because you are doing it for somebody else. But the fact is that I don't think that's happening on a large scale, but it is happening. But I think that, and I will address that, but I think the main point is that throughout places that are the places that you really think of the breadbasket, you know, Michigan where I grew up, or Illinois where I visited, Iowa, places like that, mostly if you look at a section of farmland, a section being a square mile, there's probably one big farmer, maybe two on that section. They want to be as close as possible to where all of their equipment is. So if they can't own all the land around them in their section, they rent as much of it as they can. And just for the scale of, you know, for the efficiency of being able to run their tractors down the road as little as possible. And they want to farm the land right around them. So if they don't own it, they rent it. And that's been going on forever and ever, and there's tons of people who rent their lands as farmers and kind of don't pay much attention to what happens as long as they get their check. But now these folks, the Wilkins family, are an interesting change from that, in that they're actually absorbing the expense of taking the 3 years of it, that it was required to change a piece of farmland, transition it from conventional farming to organic. And they take a risk because the farmer, the owner of that land, could definitely yank that land out from under them.
Gee, thanks for building the soil for me. Now take a hike.
Yeah, exactly. Now that you got it, great. I'm going to rent this other guy who's going to pay me $5 more an acre, or I've decided to farm it myself. Or what usually I think probably mostly happens is, you know, my family has decided to sell this piece of farmland, and now we're going to sell it, and they're going to decide what happens to it, and you can't farm it anymore. That's why in my piece, you know, I wrote about the company that I did, this Iroquois Valley Farms, mm-hmm. who have come up with a strategy to get more farmland, even rented farmland, in the hands of organic farmers, and create a system by which the farmland is not pulled out from under them after they've transitioned it.
So we're talking about a company that pools money like the rest of the companies are doing, pooling a bunch of people's money and putting them together in a big pot and going out and buying things. But we're going to do it in a little bit different way?
Yeah, that's right.
What different way?
I was spending a little bit of time with Wendell Berry about 2 years ago, and he said, I just had this guy, David Miller, come see me, and he's got this company, Iroquois Valley Farms, and it's interesting, and you should go check him out. And I said, okay, I will. And that's how I got onto this whole story. And Iroquois Valley Farms does exactly what you say. They are not quite as large scale as some of these, you know, like people like Hancock Investments or UBS AgriVest. Some of those entities don't want to make any kind of investment that's probably less than $50 million, so it's just not worth their time. But
You know, I have that problem too, come to think of it.
we've all been there. We know. We can empathize. This company, Iroquois Valley Farm, is out of the Chicago area. Started with a farm in Danforth, Illinois. That's why I went there.
Okay.
And they buy one little farm at a time and for a specific organic farmer. And they spend the money strategically to transition one piece of farmland at a time to someone who will then have the option of buying it after 7 years.
So here we have an investment firm that's trying to invest in a correct way and make money at the same time. And we're going to see how all this shakes out when we come back from this break. Does it work here in the United States? Can it work around the world? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Can renters, people who rent farmland, sustain it for the future? What do you think? 831-479-1080. Michael Olson with Dean Kuipers and Anurata Mittal. And you do stay tuned right back. Well, they say there's another way of doing it, another way of buying farmland for actual farmers and have it work out so that they can somehow survive and invest in that farmland. Dean, to what extent are these folks buying up farmland? It sounds like it's a very small, minute, tiny millimeter kind of nano part project.
Well, yeah, and let's first of all clarify that in the United States, the farmland that has been purchased by investors is still a pretty small percentage. In fact, only about 1% of all the available farmland in the country. The concern is, of course, that would grow, and as the farmland prices and food prices go up, that the speculation in farmland would increase.
Well, wait a minute. Didn't you just say that many of the farmers that you know are renting farmland?
Yes, they are. But what I'm saying is that the investment by large firms, might increase.
So it's still owned by people rather than these large investment pools.
That's right. That's right. It's only 1% of the land now is owned by these investment pools. So there are a few companies doing this. It's Iroquois Valley Farms was the one I started with. They probably only have, 3,000, 4,000 acres that they own and that they lease out to specific organic farmers at this time. But they are growing, and as this idea has caught on and their sustainable model has caught on, I think that they are getting more investment. There's another company called Grasslands LLC that was put together by Alan Savory, who is something of a ranching and grasslands guru, with his holistic grazing approach.
He's Mr. Grass.
So I understand that they have some elements of his operation. They are also, organizing the purchase of land. And there is a more sort of for-profit.
So there's essentially three or four very small organizations doing this. Anurata, do you see anything throughout the world that is comparable, or is anybody trying anything?
Well, we work in places such as, Papua New Guinea, where 98% of the land is under customary land rights,
right,
which we think is a pretty swell way of doing things, except it is facing huge challenges from the logging and the mining industry, which would like to destroy and take over this customary land right. Similarly, in Zambia, where you have 94% of the land under customary land rights, but in the absence of support for the farmers, you have no rural credit, you have no extension offices, same kind of challenges that the farmers face in this country to be able to retain their ownership of land. And, most of them are trying to make ends meet by getting a second and a third job. The pressures are too high that when the speculators move in and want to take over their lands, the difference is in places such as Papua New Guinea or Africa, it does not happen through consent or compensation for the communities. But one thing I also wanted to point out that we have seen in case of the United States, when it comes to institutional investors, Iroquois Valley Farms is amazing what they're doing, but it's very small. But when you look at the institutional investors, they will outsource the actual business of farming to tenants or to even professional farm managers. And it has created a diluted chain of responsibility that is leading to illegal business practices, and it poses safety and labor rights.
Well, let me ask you the key question on Urati. You see this happening. Do you think it's possible for a professional land manager working for a corporation who's concerned about quarterly profits to sustain farmland for the future of the country?
Well, I think you've answered the question yourself, Michael. When your primary focus, the return, is very different from the well-being of the land or creation of jobs, that's a very different set of interests. So to expect when your goal is to maximize your profits only, it is not about the future, it is not through long-term sustained earnings, which require well-being of the land, taking good care of the land, or the people that farm the land, it's not going to happen.
Dean?
I should probably jump in and say there's an interesting company here that we should maybe look at for a minute that is somewhere in between. And that is this company out of San Francisco called Farmland LP. I spent quite a bit of time talking to their CEO, Craig Wishner, who's a very interesting guy. And they have a very good farmland manager named Jason Bradford, Dr. Bradford. Their idea is that they can purchase farmland, mostly in California and Oregon at this point, and make good profits for their investors, but do the farming the right way, that they are very concerned about the way that the farming is done. They want it to be mostly organic. They have very well planned out, you know, rotation schedules for putting, you know, land in various crops and in grass and in livestock as appropriate, so that
are they the owners of the farm company? Are they the ones doing the farming?
They have a farmland manager, but then as Anurata was saying, they contract out to a local farmer. Oftentimes, from what I understand, the same farmer who may have owned or worked that piece of land before. So I think that their objective is really to have minimal change, you know, but in terms of the personnel that are actually on the land, so that people who are on the land are people who already know the land.
Okay.
But they want the practices to be as good as possible.
Gotcha.
And they claim that they can do that and still make money.
Well, when we get back from this last break, I'm going to ask both of you the big question of the day, which is, given the fact that renters really can't be all that concerned about the future of the farmland, what does that mean for our future? This is the Food Chain Radio Program, right back. Well, let's say you come home from work one day and lo and behold, you see the paint on the eaves starting to peel away. And if you're a renter, you go, oh, the paint's peeling. If you're an owner, you go, oh, the paint's peeling. I better do something about it. And so what happens if you are a renter of farmland and essentially doing the best you can to get the most for the least? You do what you can to get the most from the least, and you don't really think about the future. But if you own that farmland and your family's on that farmland, you're thinking about the future, and you're thinking about how to husband what you have for what comes later, for those who come later. So given that, and do you see a way around that, Anurata?
You know, there are different examples that are being put forward of what can happen. It is true that, you know, a lot of farmers are reporting that children do not want to stay in agriculture for obvious reasons, given, you know, they're facing such hardship. It is not easy to be a family farmer in the United States. But at the same time, while we have been doing our work, we have witnessed this increase and the surge of young, enthusiastic farmers who want to return to the land. And what they are reporting is this speculation, the prices of land, the inability to rent the land as being the main hurdle. So it is not the lack of enthusiasm, but it is really the lack of access to be able to rent a piece of land, to be able to grow food sustainably, to be connected to the land and to the community, is becoming increasingly hard in this country.
So where do you see this taking us, Anuradha? What do you see in the future, if this is the case?
I think there are two ways to go. I mean, I think this is a huge issue, and it is quite surprising that while only 1% of farmland is owned by these institutional investors, but the trend that is there, that there is no regulation, that, you know, we are forgetting a place like California. I mean, yes, we have a drought, but it used to grow 50% of the country's vegetables and fruits. And if this land is taken over, with it being determined how to use that land that will give the highest returns, that could have huge impacts on our food security, for instance. It could have huge impact on the way the lands are used environmentally and otherwise. So it is quite shocking to see that people are kind of asleep at the wheel while this big trend is happening. And I think the stakes are way too high for us not to be involved in it, and for the government not taking action, as citizens not being involved in the issue.
Well, Dean, I had a conversation with a farm reporter up in Minnesota who said that Minnesota has rules and regulations in place to protect against this kind of outright land speculation. Do you see that happening around the country?
You know what? I don't know about that, Michael. I haven't really looked into that, but that certainly seems like a good idea. And I think that we should look at this probably from the idea of sustainability and say that what I've seen, even with the time spending time on one farm, the Wilkin farm, even though I've been on other farms, that sustainability is not only possible, but it is profitable. And I think that we need to be promoting that idea in every possible way that we can, so that it can be the farmer who gets this idea that maybe
that we can
organics would be a better idea, or the landowner.
And with that, we're pretty much out of time, but want to thank Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director, Oakland Institute, Dean Kuipers, author Orion Magazine. Read the article at orionmagazine.org. It's called Buying the Farm. And thank you all for tuning in. Want you to all to remember the one big thing that Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.